Thanks a lot for the introduction and of course the invitation to be here today with you. I'm currently a postdoc in Italy, in Trieste, in the group of Enrico Brause, and I will talk about the topic here, and in particular after reviewing a couple of ongoing activities, also works I've been involved in here in Trieste. So first, a bit of motivation. Why do we study relativity in the year 2022, and what can we do in that perspective using quasi-normal modes and the shadow of black holes, and then some conclusions with open problems that we need to solve in the future. So if you have questions at any time, feel free to interrupt and let me know. So we all know relativity, Einstein's theory of gravity, has passed so far all tests with flying colors for more than 100 years. We have classical tests here, which means tests in the solar system, the reflection of light around the sun, and also terrestrial experiments measuring the redshift effect and the gravitational potential. We also have access to binary pulsar systems in the second half of the last century, like the Hals-Taylor binary system, where we already saw gravitational waves indirectly. So we have very solid tests of gravity for a long time, but we also have new ways of exploring gravity in the last years in practice. And this is, of course, related to gravitational waves that can now observe with the LIGO Virgo and now also the CAGRA gravitational wave detectors. And then probe black holes and neutron stars that collide and emit gravitational waves. And this strong field and particular dynamical aspect of gravity was so far not explored observationally, directly at least. We also have supermassive black holes that we can image with the Event Horizon Telescope. We also saw these this famous image of M87 star in the last years. So they're exciting times. And besides all the success of the general relativity, we also have some ongoing open problems that you're all familiar with. Of course, for a longer time, the origin of dark energy and also dark matter, which could or could not be related to gravity. The Hubble tension, which is more prominent in the last years. So basically the failure or the apparent discrepancy to get the Hubble parameter correctly within the error bars using early time and late time cosmological observations. So observations coming from the CMB or from type 1A supernova distance measurements. And of course, also foundational problems that are not directly to do with observations that we don't get in agreement with what we think, but concepts, of course, how we get quantum gravity somehow in the game. And there are many things that you might or might not consider as a problem. The information loss problem, for example, the rise to firewalls as another example. So there are many reasons to study gravity, in particular to look in the strong regime where we did not have the chance to be, well, that we could not explore before. Of course, if you want to do this, there are two different types of systems that conservative astrophysicists will tell you are there. These are either neutron stars or black holes. When you want to test gravity in a strong field regime, one way of doing it is, of course, to look at black holes that collide in these binary merge events. And these are the most extreme gravitational objects that we can conservatively assume in the current universe. And to describe their dynamics in the merger simulations, but also even in the ring down still, is part of what people in the field are working on these days. And of course, also when you leave general relativity, describing the strong field and alternative theories of gravity is one of the big open problems that need to be addressed when you want to understand and interpret correctly in the observations we get from LIGO. And the good thing is, of course, this is for a long time, well, it was hard to do this in practice, but now we have hundreds of events so far, around 100. But since the sensitivity increases, we will have in the next years, certainly a couple of hundreds more. And also larger signal to noise ratios, so we can explore more details of these events and use them to understand gravity. And there are clear expectations from general relativity when it comes to conservative, let's say, assumption that the black holes described in astrophysics are well approximated with the Kerr metric, followed by the theorems under certain conditions. And this means there are certain things we should expect to see when these black holes collide. So independent how the initial configuration was, the mass ratio, the orbits, when two black holes collide, you should see a ring down. And this ring down should contain characteristic frequencies and damping times that are understood as quasi-normal modes. And this means people have figured it out for a long time that when you can measure several of these frequencies and damping times in the ring down, you can actually test the black hole. Because if it's a curved black hole, there are only two free parameters, the mass and the spin, and they determine the whole spectrum. So if you can tell which mode you see, and you have a couple of them, you can test this hypothesis. And just for completeness, we have probably most of you, all of you have seen this figure, a binary black hole event. The first one that we see, we have three stages, the in-spiral, the merger, and the ring down. And for the rest of the talk, when I talk about gravitational waves, I will focus on the ring down part, not because it's better, but it's a different aspect of the three parts we have here. And I think it's interesting, particularly with the testing. They don't have theorems, and of course, testing relativity as a whole. So what are quasi-normal modes? In a nutshell, before going to any gravity-related aspects, we all know normal mode system or quasi-normal mode system from mechanical physics, from our standard courses that we had when we studied oscillation of a string, for example. If there's no friction, if energy is conserved, we have just some of sinusoids in most mechanical systems, in a simplified way. And at the moment where you add dissipation, you get the damping because energy leaves your, for example, the guitar, you play the guitar, you have sound waves, acoustic waves that drive away energy. So the oscillations damp, and this is basically described by a complex spectrum of frequencies. Now there are two parts when you write down qualitatively this problem. You have a part that is related to the properties of the object that you study, which are these unperturbed system properties, which are the eigenvalues of a system in this picture.
So great. Sebastian, I think there is a question here. Hand up. Yes.
I ask about equation one. There a minus sign missing here or not?
This is, I mean, not related to gravity. This is just generically putting it here. I mean, you can put a minus sign, or it depends on your definition of omega, of the imaginary part in the end. I mean,
okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Also, these indices here, we'll say something about them in a second. So the first thing in blue here are these eigenvalues. They are system properties. If you have your guitar or your string, these are really the things before you perturb the system that you can compute. The excitation coefficients here, they tell you how much such an amplitude is excited. They depend how you perturb the system. So this is something that you cannot compute before you perturb the system because it depends exactly how you do it. And these two things, out of a black hole, the ring down, are important to distinguish and to understand. And here below, as a little visualization, if you would stand far away from a black hole and you send in a gravitational wave and you wait until part of it comes back, this is what happens. This is how the waveform could look like for an observer far away. So the amplitude of such a way, this is all now near our perturbation theory, is described by a sum of these damped frequencies. You can see on the right-hand side a logarithmic scaling, how dominant the fundamental mode here in that case looks. It's basically just one frequency that you see. If you look on the right-hand side, if you would zoom in more around the peak region, you could actually see some overtones, but overtones are damped out faster, so you don't see them in the later part of the signal. So basically, quasi-normal modes here are just the sum of damped frequencies of a system that you excite. So without talking about gravity, that's how you can imagine them. And when you want to study them for black holes, there are different things you can do. So if you want to approach the problem for the first time and you want to understand qualitatively what's happening, the simplest case you can study, a textbook example, is you'd study the wave equation of a free scalar field. It's a toy problem. And here the wave operator will take the background metric that you want to study. And then you can compute what happens with the field. And we will see that this will give rise to quasi-normal modes in the end. So this equation here, rather general, if you put in the Schwarzschild metric as the default case, and you do a couple of calculations during your calculation, you can basically arrive at this very nice result, which is that the problem in the end for the Schwarzschild spacetime can be written in the form of a time-independent Schrödinger equation that we are familiar from quantum mechanics, with a few little details that are different. So first of all, let's go for the different parts. We have a radial coordinate here, R star. This is the so-called tortoise coordinate. And this is related to the metric that you have. In the case of Schwarzschild, that's rather simple, but this is also true for other spherically symmetric space times. So it's a coordinate that depends on the metric, and you need this to get it in this nice form. And the other thing, which is not so trivial, is because this is in the R star coordinate, and the potential right here is in this radial coordinate that you have in the Schwarzschild metric. If you want to really explicitly write it out in terms of R star, you have to invert this tortoise coordinate, and that is a bit messy. But in this form, it looks very nice, very simple, simple problem to solve. This L here comes from the decomposition into the spherical harmonics that you use during the wave. So this is a separation constant that you get. So the angular part decouples in the case of Schwarzschild, and all that is left here is solved as radial equation. So the quasi-normal modes omega that you get after the Fourier transform, they are defined by the boundary conditions. So equation three itself does not define anything for omega unless you define what happens at the boundaries. And the standard boundary condition that people use to study quasi-normal modes is to have outgoing waves at infinity, which means you don't want to have any radiation coming in, and you want to have ingoing waves at the horizon of the black hole, so nothing comes out of the black hole. These two assumptions define you the quasi-normal mode spectrum, and if you repeat the game and you take the full GR field equations and you study perturbations of the Schwarzschild metric, and you would linearize the Einstein field equations, and you would go through a tensor equivalent calculation, then you would find there are two types of perturbations for the metric called axial and polar, depending on how they transform under parity transformations. And they give rise to potentials that look actually very similar. So the axial potential is called the Reggie-Wheeler potential. And besides, in the second bracket, a minus six instead of a plus two as a factor, it is exactly the same potential. And you also have this time-independent Schrödinger equation that you have to solve. That's a really equation comes for these other gravitational perturbation. It looks different if you look at it just here from the equations. The lambda is a longer expression that also contains L. But if you actually visualize them here in this tortoise coordinate, they look all very similar qualitatively. So it's true that the scalar potential is a little bit larger for a given value of L here, but all the features related to the spectrum are very similar to the axial and polar case. And the axial and polar case are both looking very different analytically. They look very similar here if you visualize them, but they are actually even closer than it seems from here. They have exactly the same spectrum. So they're isospectral. Even if they look differently, even if the potentials are not the same, they are transformations, and you can prove, there are different ways to prove this, that the spectrum is isospectral. So you have the same eigenvalues, both potentials in the quasi-normal mode case. That's a very nice finding, and something that is also not unique to GR, but something that is a property of GR in that case. So how does the spectrum look like? This is how it looks like for the axial case, which is the same as the polar case. This is the complex plane. You have the frequency real part on the x-axis and the imaginary part on the y-axis. And this is for the L equals two case, for the spherical harmonic L equals two. It looks qualitatively similar if you go to larger L. And this is a very particular special spectrum of eigenvalues, I would say. So first of all, let's go through the different properties. So the fundamental mode is defined as the frequency with the smallest imaginary part. And this is the one around 0.37, which is around here. And this is the one that in the ring down picture I had before is the dominant mode. So if you wait some time, this is the frequency that you will see in the ring down. The overtones are these other points, all the other points basically here, that have a larger imaginary part. This means they are damped out faster, and it's harder to get them from a time evolution point of view. The interesting thing is that the real part of the frequency goes actually down when you increase the overtone. And this is very counterintuitive. If you have never seen this, you would have expected an overtone, when people talk about an overtone, has a larger frequency, because if you have any instrument or a mechanical system, this is typically what happens. Overtones have a higher frequency and they have a higher damping time. In that case, only the dampened time goes up, because by definition, overtones are those with the larger imaginary parts. And then you approach always one mode, so algebraically special mode, where the real part vanishes completely. And then the modes align nicely, like some constant real part. So these points actually go on forever, as there are infinitely many eigenvalues. There's nothing more happening more or less after this point. So they all line up with a constant spacing, with a constant real part. So this is maybe unexpected. If you look at the potentials and you never study the problem, computing them is not so straightforward. It depends how you, well, what part of the spectrum you want. There are different methods that you can use. Yeah, maybe I'll say something about this later unless there are questions for this now. But this is how the quasi-null modes of a Schwarzschild black hole look like. So when you study this for gravitational perturbations, obviously this depends on the theory that you choose. So in general relativity, Reggio-Vila and Cirilli have worked this out for the Schwarzschild case. And later Tarkovsky has showed it for the Kerr metric. And this is significantly different because in that case, you don't perturb the metric directly. There's a different formalism of doing it. And the end, the surprising thing is that you still have to solve a system of decoupled equations where you have a radial part and an angular part. There are again separation constants, which are more complicated to compute because you don't have spherical harmonics in the anymore. Also not tensor spherical harmonics, but spin weighted spheroidal harmonics. But in the end, you still have to solve a radial wave equation. If you think about beyond GR, just very qualitatively, what could happen looking at the previous equations. So if you have, for example, theories in which you have the Schwarzschild black hole as a solution, you may still have, maybe for axial, maybe for polar, maybe for both, the same perturbation. You could also think about a case where you have Schwarzschild black holes, but the perturbation equations are different. Of course, you could also have non-Schwarzschild black holes, non-GR perturbation equations. And if you look in the literature for cases where people look for quasi-normal modes of rotating black holes, then there's not very much that you find because it's very complicated to construct these solutions in the first place, and then studying the perturbations on top is usually quite involved. So the fact that it decouples in generativity is not a general feature. So you cannot expect in a general theory that if you study perturbations, you end up with the simple Schrödinger type of equation or something equivalent to the Tarkovsky equation. So there are some qualitative features of GR that you maybe want to keep in mind as a very nice property. So again, the perturbation equations are separable. That's an important thing. The other thing is there are no couplings to other fields. So you could also imagine that if you have scalar field, that this scalar field couples to one of your, to the axial of the polar perturbations, and there are some theories in which it's the case. And of course, in non-rotating case, you can also have situations with axial and polar perturbations are not isospectral anymore, just in principle. So there are different ways, if you want to think beyond GR, how you can go. There's one maybe more phenological driven way in which you just start from the perturbation equations and think how things could be different and start to modify them. And then see if you can constrain these modifications and how far you can play this game. On the other hand, you can also come from a more theory dependent way, and you can start from a more fundamental theory and then try to derive the perturbation equations of the background, that solution that you also have to find first. And that second case, it's of course much cleaner how to interpret something that you see, because there's a clear connection from your metric, for your dynamics to the observation. If you do these phenomenological modifications, for example, modifying the potential, this by itself does not tell you directly something about the underlying theory. But of course, it's an attractive problem because you can actually do something in an easier way, and you can at the same time constrain something. Before you don't know where it may come from a fundamental point of view. Another thing I just want to briefly mention here, and that's in that perspective, of course, we can have small modifications that between M's are different, but there are also smoking gun differences that could be there are very popular in the last years that run under the name of echoes. So what are echoes? When I introduced in the beginning the population of the scalar field, I said the ingoing boundary condition of the black hole is that there is nothing that comes out. If you start to change this, if you say there is some reflection because there's not a real black hole horizon, but I have something that is ultra compact, it looks like a black hole all the way out, but just very close to the horizon, there is some sort of firewall or reflective surface. Then you could imagine that some of the radiation comes back and bounces back to this potential peak. And then what happens is that there is some radiation that is trapped between this of the potential and your ingoing, your inside, basically. And this gives rise to reflections depending on how you prepare the system in the beginning. And if this cavity that you have between the peak and your would-be horizon is large enough, you can get these repeated sort of signals which come from waveforms that go from some peak radiation. It goes always between one side and the other, and there's always one part that goes over the barrier, basically gets transmitted and can be seen far away. You can motivate this from assuming some quantum gravitational effects or effective models. That's one way. This is how it is popular in recent years. But it's interesting that this same happens even with the simplest relativistic models of a star. If you take a constant density star as an extreme case, you can make the star so compact that you actually get a very similar feature in the waveform. So if there would be something like ultra constant density stars, which there is no evidence that there is, but if there would be, they would have very similar features in the waveform. And that would be a smoking gun effect that there is something different. And the interesting thing is that the first response that you get would still look very much like a Schwarzschild black hole, because this part originates from this part of the potential around the peak. Just at later times, you might see these outgoing pulses, and then you would say, okay, this cannot be a normal black hole because there's something that reflects radiation, so it must be something else. What the something else is of course a different story, but this is a smoking gun how things could be different. So let's go towards a bit the direction of the work I'm doing. I'm interested in particular basically on inverse problems. So let's say that we know quasi-normal modes from future observations very precisely, or as a academic problem, you have some numbers, which are the frequencies, and you want to know what can you tell about the underlying metric that is there. What is the space-time metric of a black hole that has certain quasi-normal modes? Or for example, if you have these quasi-normal modes, what can you tell about the potential? Could you identify coupling to additional fields? Is there a way how you can invert the problem, basically? And there are a couple of works that I was involved in the last years about this. This is from Enrico Barrause, where we basically address this first question, where we try to make connections with black holes, which are not Schwarzschild spherical symmetry. So there are a couple of pieces go together here. So there's a market, let's say, for parameterized black hole metrics. That are not a solution to a particular theory, but which are, let's say, a clever expansion of how metrics, black hole metrics, could look like. And the motivation, one of the motivations of these metrics is that you can use them if you have, for example, numerical spacetimes, numerical solutions for a black hole metric, and you want to do analytic calculations with this. Then you could use one of these frameworks, match the parameters, and you would get a very precise fit of this. And then you would have an analytic representation of this. This can be useful if you want to do ray tracing, but it can also be useful if you want to have a model for a metric with a few parameters that hopefully is good enough to describe various modifications of Schwarzschild that could be there. The metric alone, of course, does not give you any idea how gravitational perturbations act on them. So you need to make some assumptions of how this could be the case. Or you study a scalar test field. We make the assumption that basically the background equations would be fulfilled by this metric, which is not the case. So this is basically the cooked up part here, but it gives you something that in the limit that you have GR works. And it also, for some theories where the dynamics are different, is a good approximation. So we have some cases where we can see that this is the level of getting the metric from some assumed dynamics something that at least makes partially sense. It makes also sense from the point of view that the icon limit, you get back what you would expect from jar. Icon limit means large L. And we can also parameterize deviations from this assumption, from this dynamics, by adding additional terms here on the level of the potential. In this work, we have chosen one additional parameter. You could also think of Taylor expansion of unknown functions, and you would try to determine these parameters. So this is all on the level of the potential. There's no direct connection to something that could point out to what is the action of the theory. So this is basically the question, how well does a metric connect the QNMs with the dynamics? So, and this is the setup of the problem that we want to study. The metric, in case you wonder how this looks like, has this form. This is the Rizzo-Lazarenko metric. So it's circularly symmetric. There are two functions that are determined by continued fraction, basically, this n, b, which are redefined here by this function a of x, b of x. X is a coordinate that maps the horizon and the plus infinity to 0, 1. And this metric, using only a few parameters, has been shown to be a very good approximation to many known black hole solutions that are there. So what did we do? We assumed we have the GR QNMs, and we wanted to see how well do the Schwarzschild QNMs actually constrain the metric if you would have this sort of dynamics, this wave equation there. So what we did is we did the Markov chain Monte Carlo analysis for that. So we said, let's say we have the fundamental mode, the first overtone for the L equals 2, L equals 3. We have different cases in this paper. And we assume we know them very precisely in the future with, let's say, 1%. You can have a large error, a smaller error. You can put in that sense what you want. The question is, can you constrain the parameters of the metric from that? And can you constrain the potential? Can you constrain the metric as a whole? And we have four parameters here. Three are from the Rizzo-Lazarenko metric, M is the last of the black hole. And we have run the Markov chain Monte Carlo, and we get the posteriors of these parameters. This is what we see in the left-hand side plot. So the diagonal panels here show you what are our
questions.
Yes.
Can I ask a question here? So sure. You mentioned about this ISO spectrum, right? Like the axial and polar modes have the same frequencies, but yet their potential look very different. So I'm just not sure how you can just based on the quaternary mode frequency recover the shape of the potential, because axial potential and polar potential, they just look quite different. Yeah,
exactly. So this is a very good point, because all of this, even if you would have infinitely many modes, that's a very good point. There is not a single unique reconstruction that you can get from in general. If you would have a most generic form of how you can parameterize something, you would not be able to get a unique mapping back. But still, you can, if you have some finite parameters, if you would assume that this metric is a good representation of what is there with a limited number of parameters, you could still try to see what are the parts that are more constrained than others in this game. So mathematically, you can show there are transformations that give you one potential that is isospectral to others. You can, in principle, construct many different potentials, but then all these potentials, if you connect them with the metric, maybe have a meaningful or reasonable metric. So if you assume some structure for the metric and some structure for the dynamics, then you can see how these things relate. And in that case, you can see here on the left side again, the posteriors, and you can see in these off diagonal panels the correlations of the parameters. So basically, how they are impacting the spectrum. And on the right-hand side, you see now, how does it look like if you convert these posteriors to potentials? So what are the potentials and the metrics that are described by the parameters here on the left? So to do so, you take samples from the posterior, and then you evaluate what the potential is, what the metric is, as is shown here on the right in different colors. So we take many times different samples from the posteriors, and then we overplot here for, this is just for visuals, how this looks like, how the potentials look like, how the metrics look like that you can get. So of course, there are some features which come by construction. For example, that far away, the metric is basically the same as Schwarzschild. This is the construction of the metrics. So far away, you will always find it's the metric. described by this. But you can see if you approach basically the horizon, the uncertainty increases by a lot. So this is the part that is not so well constrained for the metric. For the potential, on this figure here, you can see that the peak of the potential is still well constrained. And when you go closer to the horizon, basically you lose a lot of predictability, what should be there, even if it's just four parameters. If you turn on this parameter that I introduced before that says, okay, this is how dynamics could be modified in the simplest way, just by a constant, then it gets already much more complex. So you can see this beautiful structure of several peaks in the posteriors. So now it's not just that you get your injection, basically, yes, this is the most likely point. No, you get these longer correlations. So you see there's a let's say less predictive structure of what's there. And this is only with five parameters. If you convert this now again to potentials and the metric on the right-hand side, you can see that the uncertainties, of course, because you have more parameters, is much larger. But if you look closely to the peak of the potential, you see that the uncertainty there is much smaller than even left and right of it. So if you know how you can compute quasi-normal modes with WKB theory, or are familiar with this topic, and you know that the quasi-normal modes are mostly determined from the properties of the potential around the peak. And this is basically what you can see here. So even when you vary many parameters, it's not that all parts of the potential of the metric are equally less constrained. There are some parts which are more constrained if you have a finite set of parameters. And this is the region around the peak, which is very close to the light ring.
Sebastian, do you mind if I ask a question?
Sure, go ahead.
So we've had lots of discussions within this group about quasi-normal modes, and recently we've been, we've been educated about the fact that if you perturb the potential a little bit, the quasi-normal modes can change a lot. You know, that's the issue mm-hmm. of, you know, pseudo-spectral instability, that sort of thing. So the question I have is, so what you measure is actually the time signal, right? I mean, you see the gravitational wave, it has a certain, you know, time profile, and you can always try to extract quasi-normal modes from the time profile. But even that's not a guaranteed thing, because you can have many different mode structures that will give you essentially, you know, within uncertainties, you know, experimental uncertainties, they will all give you essentially the same time profile. So the mapping from the time series to the modes is all, you know, is already something that's not, you know, a unique inverse problem as far as I understand it. So have you thought about how to fold that into the discussion?
Yes and no. So I'm familiar with the works you mentioned. Actually, I had the pleasure to be around with Nolet, the same department at right. some time. So basically what the mention is that if you modify the potential a bit somewhere, the QNM spectrum can be completely different, but the time evolution still would look very similar for the eigenvalues are different. So yes, there are limitations to how you can modify the potential and still make this identification. So it's true, if you have the time series, it's not easy to, first of all, even if you have multiple overtones in the standard case, it's not trivial to get all of them. You will never get all of them. If there is not the identification that the frequencies you see are the frequencies of the system, there's a problem. But in the early part of the ring down, it's still described basically by the potential around the maximum. So I would still think that the potential you get in that case is recovered around the peak well. It's just that the mathematical eigenvalues of the space-time are not the ones that you see in the signal. But still, right. from the time evolution, you would get the potential right. So
that's what I was wondering, whether, you know, there might not be a way to do an inverse problem without involving the modes, but just, you know, trying to map the time signal
yes.
to an effective potential without, you know, the modes sort of murking up the formulation of that inverse problem.
Yeah, there are interesting, I mean, there are for the Schrodinger equation, there are works on this. If, I mean, I don't have the reference in my head now, but for an end. Well, you can do this, that's true. But usually what you have to do there is you need to know what you send in, basically. So if you would, on the computer, you can play this game. You send in whatever wave package you have, and then you measure what comes back. And by what you measure from what comes back, you can tell what the potential is. It's also not unique, if I remember correctly, but you can say something about the potential there. But the problem, I think, is never follow this more, is that you need to understand what you send in, because the reconstruction depends on this in that case. So if you don't have a controlled way of sending in waves, then yeah, that's difficult. Maybe it makes sense if you have something like an ENRI, where a small object can be treated perturbatively, and then you look at the waveform from that and try to get the perturbation theory back. But
yeah, it's worth thinking about. But anyway, thank you. That clarifies my thinking.
Okay. Okay. Are there any questions for this part of this problem? And I would go on to the next. Okay. So the problem I described before in the set of equations, basically it's axial potential equation, makes certain assumptions, of course, on how the problem can be. And one strong assumption is that there is no coupling to other fields. In principle, you can have additional fields, a scalar field that would in some theories also couple to your gravitational perturbations. And the way how you can study this, again, surface symmetry, is by considering a system like equation 11, which looks similar to before, but now we promoted V to be a matrix containing diagonals, basically the, for example, the Reticular potential or the potential for the scalar perturbations, and then describing coupling functions in the off-diagonal terms. So in GR, this thing would basically have no diagonal terms if you would have axial and polar and you're happy. In general, if you have other fields, they can couple in this way. And there's a framework described by Cardoso and McManus in two papers 2 years ago, where they basically say, okay, let's assume the perturbations, the corrections in the potential, they are small, and then there are small coupling functions, small modifications, and they enter the potential in the following way, in this expansion RH over R. RH is the horizon Schwarzschild metric, R is your radial coordinate, and K is some integer power. So in principle, you could think that if you have a general coupling function or modification to the potential, if you make this expansion and you take enough terms, it hopefully recovers what is really there. And if these things are small, you can linearize your quasi-normal mode calculation. You need to find these coefficients numerically, there are different ways how you can do it. Then you can express the quasi-normal mode frequencies with respect to the GR ones plus small corrections, which are given here in equation 14. So the IJK are the coefficients that describe the linear corrections. IJ is the index of the field or the coupling function. So if you think of a 2×2 matrix, you could have axial, for example, in the 0,0 component, you would have the scalar potential and the 1,1. Then you would have coupling functions in the 1,0 and 0,1. Term here. You can also have frequency dependent corrections to the potential, and that makes the whole thing much more ugly, but it can happen in some cases. You can also compute those. And then you can have quadratic corrections, of course, and the principal higher orders, which are in this captured in this mess of EIJ, PQ, KS. So KS here are the different powers of K and S. This is a product of basically one of our R terms, and you compute these coefficients once. And the nice thing is, if you can map your problem to this form in equation 11, where you have a mapping of your theory to these coefficients, you can directly compute the QNMs if you know what these alphas are. So that's very convenient. You don't have to do any difficult calculation if you can map it to this framework. So this is very, very nice if you think that corrections are small. And the original authors, they have done it for the fundamental mode. For our work, we also included this to the overtones, the first and the second, because we wanted to see what happens if you know many QNMs. And the corrections to the QNMs are visualized here. So let's maybe focus on the top panel first. What I show here are the real and imaginary part of the quasi-normal mode frequencies for the fundamental mode, and the first and second overtones described by different line types. The solid line describes the fundamental mode, the dotted dash describes the first overtone, and the dotted one describes the second overtone. And I vary one of these alpha parameters for different k's on each of the line from -1 to 1. So the blue line here corresponds to how the QNMs change when you go from alpha minus one to alpha plus one, only for the k equals two correction. So only the one over r squared term, basically. You can do the same varying only the k equals four, the k equals six, and in principle, all of them. This is how the quasi-normal modes change if you do this. What you see in this plot is that if you take the same value for k, the overturn corrections, they are kind of similar. They're not the same, but they go in the same direction. Once you change your order for k, this whole thing starts to rotate a bit. The length here depends on how strong the impact of this modification is for the same value of alpha. So it goes down with higher values of k in that framework. And if you look at the coefficients themselves, how these coefficients look like, these are shown in the bottom panels, basically again for the three different type of modes. On the left-hand side, these are these linear corrections. And on the right-hand side, these are the diagonal terms, the quadratic corrections. In both cases, for the axial potential, the other coefficients look qualitatively similar. And you can see this very nice pattern on the fashion on the right-hand side. But if you zoom in, the first few are different qualitatively from the rest. That they increase a lot with the overtone. It also makes sense, the overtone in absolute values is larger. So if you have the same value of alpha, you can also have larger coefficients to get the same correction, sort of, if you want to think of it in this way. So what can you do with this? So you can use it also for the inverse problem. Because if you assume that these corrections are small and you have this basis and you have know how to compute it, you can use a lot of basis functions in principle. Again, there's no guarantee that this is a complete set of everything that can happen, but it's a practical way how you can get many modifications in. And what we do here is we study different cases where things are modified. So the top case shows you a modification in the potential of the axial case. Some sort similar to what was in the first case, but in that case, no assumption of the metric, everything is on the level of the potential. And then we inject basically this modification. We compute the quasi-normal modes with an exact method, numerically, let's say, numerical errors with the EVA method, which is, let's say, the status quo of how you can, how precise you can compute QNMs. And then we use this quadratic expansion and we do a principal component analysis. And what a principal component analysis does is it gives you the relevant combination of basis vectors that you can extract from data. So let's say I have 10 basis functions and I have a few numbers that I can measure. It's clear that you cannot determine what the different basis functions are, all of them individually, right? What you can constrain is a combination of them. The most significant combinations, they are found by this principal component analysis. And you can see this improves when you include the number of overtones in that case. So going from just the fundamental mode to the first and including the second overtone, you can get a pretty good reconstruction of what you injected. But you can also use this now to study the coupled system, which is more complicated to compute normally. But with this framework, it's very similar. So on the bottom left panel, I have injected basically quasi-normal modes from dynamical transignments, which you have scalar field coupled to the axial perturbation. And in that case, the only modification that comes in this framework is a coupling function that is a metric or the 0, 1, the 1, 0 in this matrix. So if you make the assumption that there is a modification which is symmetric coupling functions and does not modify the potential, then you can again run your PCA analysis and you can get in that case also the coupling function back. So this is showing you the different colors. These are error bars I should have mentioned corresponding to 2 sigma basically. And it's not exact what you can get back, also partially because the injection has been again computed using basically the precise QNMs. And the reconstruction is, of course, limited to the imprecision of using this quadratic approximation. On the right-hand side, it's one additional level of complexity. You have two coupling functions now, which are not the same. They're not symmetric. So the black line here shows you the injection. And you see in the top panel, it's smaller than in the middle panel. But the PCA, when you just run it, it will find you something in that case that is looking similar for both of them. So in that case, you can see there are two coupling functions. There is some sort of counterbalance between them. And you can also from this parameterized framework see that they're actually, that the product of them is actually what is invariant here. So if you inject these two cases, then you can actually still recover the product of them quite well. So not the individual ones in that case, that's to the generate, but the product of them is something that is more robustly constrainable in this framework. So I spoke a lot of quasi-normal modes now. There are also a few things about shadows I wanted to mention. So I'm sure most of you have seen the movie Interstellar. It's this beautiful black hole that they sort of animated, simulated altogether. There's a lot of structure here, and this structure can also be used to test generativity. So this is taken from an Event Horizon Telescope publication about the M87 observation. And the top panel, you can see precise GRMHD simulations that basically show you how the image would look like if you would have super high resolution VHD. And there's a ring structure here. This ring structure appears for different black hole spins in that case of the inclination. So in the top panel description, you can see it's a very fast spinning black hole, the left and the right panel in different directions. And in the center, not spinning at all. If you blur it up to the image quality that you can reconstruct, they all look very similar. So it's hard to get the rotation out of these images. But yeah, you can do tests of GR with this still under certain assumptions. The way how you do it is you study geodesics in the space time. And this is one part of the problem. This is the part of the problem that gives you the connection with the metric. The other part, which is more complicated, is to actually describe the matter there properly, what is happening, what gives rise to the emission of light, what absorbs light. So this is very complicated physics that I don't want to address here really much. Just from this geodesic point of view, the ring that you see mostly originates from photons come basically from the photon ring. So this size of this ring is related to the impact parameter here, of photons coming very close from the photon ring. So this is the main feature, basically light that comes from this region. This makes up the ring that we see. Again, if you use this, if you want to do this very like properly, if you want to make a realistic simulation, you need to do GRMHD and then do involve ray tracing to get this image. There was a follow-up paper by the collaboration basically where they were saying that you can use the size of this ring that the collaboration was estimating with around 17%, taking into account observations of stars further away and the knowledge of the distance to the source, that everything is in agreement with GR with 17% roughly. And then this is the claim that you can also do tests beyond the first Poissonian order of the black hole metric. This was a strong claim, which is only valid under certain assumptions, and how robust this analysis is was the topic of another project together with Enrico Barauze, Nicola Franchini, and Avery Broderick. We basically wanted to see how robust is this conclusion that you take the size of this black hole and say something about a post-Poissonian order of the metric. So there are basically two extreme cases. Maybe let's first say, what is this PN metric? So if you take a spherical symmetric black hole and you would write it spotted in this way, that you have corrections in terms of M over R, there's some coefficient pi. Then the statement is basically, if you take the size of the shadow with some uncertainty, you can put bounds on these coefficients pi. In GR, they're all zero, if you would think this is a Schwarzschild black hole, but in principle, they could be non-zero. So the shadow size analytically is related to the photon ring and the impact parameter given by this equation here. So you can actually, if you make this identification, this is a strong assumption that the ring that you see really comes from very close to this photon ring impact parameter. So if you assume this analytic relation holds, which makes of course some assumptions also about the astrophysics to some extent, where does the light emission come from in the disk, what is the disk geometry? But even if you take this for granted, it depends of course how many you vary at the time of these parameters. So if you say you're optimistic, there's only one term, let's say appearing at r equal r to the power of, I don't know, -5, Then this is a single parameter. You have a single observable. There is some finite error with which you can constrain this parameter. I think that's clear. The thing that is maybe misleading is that this expansion does not necessarily converge well if you're very close to a black hole. So the solar system, this makes sense. These M over R terms, they're very small for higher powers. So these contributions of PI, when they are all of, let's say, order one, it would be strongly suppressed. So it would make sense to say I can test the leading order terms of this metric. But if you're close to the black hole and the ring is around 3M, the bottom ring, then this does not converge fast. So here you see optimistic situations in which we varied only one of these PI coefficients. We took the analytic relation, we did our Markov chain Monte Carlo, and then you basically get these blue posteriors. This is our knowledge of the parameter if you vary one at a time, and you can see that the higher orders are constrained. The error bar increases a bit, but you can imagine that if you turn on two of them, they have an impact on each other. And the pessimistic case, or maybe the most agnostic case, is that you say, well, why should there only be one? There could be many of them. So we took the Rizzo-Lazarenko metric with a couple of parameters there, and then we played the same game, we sampled, and we computed basically always the shadow size. And then you get these orange posteriors here, which are just these, well, there's nothing to learn here. Because if you have multiple parameters at the same time and you just look at what is the corresponding PN coefficient, then you cannot constrain it. There are too many things vary at the time. They are all important, so you don't learn much from that if you are more agnostic. But what you can do, and this is beautiful, is you can relate GTT and the derivative of GTT at the light ring, whatever the light ring is, that metric, analytically. So what you see here as black solid line is basically the value of GTT and GTT prime along the whole Schwarzschild space time from the horizon up to plus infinity. So the light ring corresponds to this intersection with the dashed line. The dashed line is the prediction that you would get from this shadow size identification with the impact parameter, the photon ring. If this is the case, then whatever you get should be along this dashed line. The dotted points here are the uncertainties that you would get in that case. We have assumed even 5%, just to make sure, or to make clear that this is not related to the 17% that you don't know all of them, but this is an inherent problem. So the prediction that you should see, if you do the same thing now for many different metrics, is that you should constrain at the light ring GTT and GTT prime along this line. And in blue, you see histograms of exactly this. When you sample from your posterior, all these wild possibilities of the PN parameters at the light ring of this metric, this is what we get. This is the constraint that you can put from the shadow size in that simple case. If you evaluate the metric a bit further away or closer to the horizon, then you get these red and green histograms. In principle, if you would have a more general metric, they would be even more spread out. So there's nothing that predicts them from the shadow size, only this blue line. So this is what you can constrain in that case. So the other question that you can ask is, of course, okay, this identification with the ring is based on certain assumptions. There's a whole image that you can in principle use to learn something. How can you do it? What can you learn? So if you only consider the ring, you throw away information. But of course, studying the whole image is very complicated, even in spherical symmetry. You need to make some assumptions of the accretion models. This is very non-trivial to model, of course. So we don't expect to get a realistic description of the inverse problem in a general case. So to see how well or not how well you can reconstruct modifications in the metric with those coming from uncertainties in your accretion flow, or basically the light is produced around the black hole, there's a project by Guillermo Lara, who is a is a PhD student here and is finishing in the summer. We did a PCA analysis of the problem that we now vary the metric and the astrophysics and see what you can get if you vary both at the time. So on the left-hand side, you see a simple model for the emission profile that can either be a sum of Gaussians in the way how it is modified or a simple power law. On the right-hand side, you can see modification. They introduced a bump in the metric somewhere at 7M, and there are two cases. Let's assume that you know the background metric would be Schwarzschild, and you produce an image that comes from Schwarzschild and uses the emissivity profile that you assume to be a power law. Then you can, using the PCA, constrain basically what this injection was with a sum of Gaussians that in this PCA give you this superposition of basis functions. So the blue here gives you the constraint that you can get from the data, from the image, if you would know that the background is Schwarzschild. So you take basically the image and you say, this is the emission profile, assuming some model, of course, how it is produced. And then you can say what it is. If you change the metric and you would assume that the emission profile is not completely unknown, not like a superposition of 50 Gaussians or something, but a power law with a few parameters. If you say this is the model for the emissivity, but you don't know what the metric is, there could be a superposition of many Gaussians, then you can still reconstruct the metric. If you say both are superposition of Gaussians, each point you don't know what it is, then you can imagine this is very degenerate. And in that case, we did not find a clear way robustly to disangle the two things, which probably you would expect. But if you want to test, of course, relativity or the metric with the EHT image, you need to be aware of that there are uncertainties in the astrophysics. If you don't believe the theory, the uncertainties in the metric, and getting both out at the same time is very difficult if you take the full image. There are works now where people use more than just one ring, several rings. They also consider rotation, where you don't have a ring, but it basically deforms the parameter describing how non-circular it is. And then you have multiple parameters, and then you can actually also constrain the metric. But again, making signification that some features in the image come from these analytic properties, and not taking into account the complexity of these GRMHD simulations. So let me conclude. So I have spoken a lot about two aspects of black holes and how we can use them to test relativity. One was focusing on quasi-normal modes. So maybe to contrast the two, in contrast to shadow images, I would say quasi-normal modes are a cleaner test in some sense, even at least when it comes to astrophysics. If you have two black holes that collide, you don't expect there is much matter, so there shouldn't be large corrections to what the metric is from that. The data becomes available in the future. Last year, I saw you had a talk by Maximiliano Easy, who was talking about getting overtones from real data with LIGO data, which is very difficult. There's also an ongoing debate of whether we have actually found overtones in the data or not, because it is very sensitive to the analysis you make, apparently. So this will resolve in the future when we have better data. For sure, we will see some structure of the overtones. How many and how precise, that of course depends on the event. Regarding theory-specific tests that you could do with quasi-normal modes, it's very difficult for rotating black holes, which you need for LIGO in the end. So that's an open problem if you want to have one. And background metrics exist in a parameterized form. So it's not a problem that we don't know how can I parameterize a black hole and it's not GR. But the difficult part is, in that case, of course, to get a dynamic somehow in the picture and see how things evolve if you're not making assumptions that corrections are small. The shadow images are maybe more theory agnostic. If you assume the geodesic motion is right, then you can study these parameterized metrics in a more robust way. And in this case, the dynamics basically are your geodesics, and you need to understand your, of course, the emission profile and all the astrophysics, if you want to talk about the whole image, that's very involved. But if you make these identifications with certain features in the image, then this could be a very robust way, maybe in the future, next generation EHT, to put constraints on how the metric around the supermassive black hole can be different. Of course, compared to LIGO, the number of sources that the EHT can observe is really limited. So we will not see hundreds of images in the future. This is for the far, far future, maybe. So there are certain, of course, benefits of both of them. I think they're both exciting, great to test GR from different perspectives. And with that, yeah, I want to close the talk. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Sebastian, for the very nice talk. Questions? So maybe I can ask a question. So can you go back like two slides? So I was wondering So what does this show? Are you saying that you can constrain GTT as a function R? So what data are you using to make this plot?
Okay, yeah, I was a bit quick here because it was the end of the talk. So what we do in the study is a like proof of principle. You have the possibility that you have modifications in the metric, which we describe in a basis of a lot of Gaussian. So you have a lot of Gaussians at different points in the space-time. Not because we think one Gaussian is the modification, but if you take many Gaussians, you can basically describe any modification if you take enough of them. This is a general basis in some sense, but it's not something that we can constrain each component of like each Gaussian. What we do is we use a model for how the emissivity profile looks like and use geodesics basically to compute the image. And then we take this image and we ask the question, okay, if there's a bump in the metric somewhere, can we get this bump from the image using this principal component analysis? So we take our image modified by a bump where we of course say what is the emissivity profile, and then we see, okay, using the PCA, depending of course how big this bump is, where it is, you can get reconstructions of this bump. And you can get reconstructions in the case where you say, I know exactly how the emissivity profile is, which would be like the toy problem assumption that you know exactly what your accretion flow looks like in some sense. But we can also get it if the emissivity profile is simple, described by a simple model like power law, a few parameters. In that case, the fitting basically is good enough to get both. If you say the emissivity profile is something I have no idea how it looks like, and you also write it as a sum of many Gaussians, then you want to vary both, then it's too degenerate and it's very hard to get something back. But if you say you know the background metric and you only want to get from the image the emissivity profile with this PCA with the many Gaussians, then you get this blue area. So in that case, you can get it.
Okay.
Question.
There is a question from chat from Yun Fan. Yun, do you want to ask or do you want me to read the chat? So what if the deviation of the potential from a pure black hole is due to environmental matter distribution, but not beyond GR? Can you still recover the potential? So that's the question.
Okay. So that's basically, let me go back maybe to one of these plots with the potential. Okay. So if you think there's some matter in the space time, you could think that the potential is, of course, it's modified in some way. You can write in sort of symmetry analytically down how this should look like as a function of the shell of masses that you put somewhere. And there are also studies of how you evolve quadrinormal modes. So the analysis, depending on how you do it, for the time evolution, if you focus on this part of the peak and you don't assume there's a lot of matter around this peak region, that should still be robust for the time evolution. If you have bumps far away, a shell of matter far away, then you can have something similar as echoes in some sense, not exactly the same, but you can have a secondary bump somewhere far away. Then you could also think that if you send in some radiation, there's a trapping between the matter and the potential. And in that case, the late times across normal modes would probably look different. Also the eigenvalues of the space-time look different, but that's a bit tricky because what defines you mathematically the eigenvalues of this potential is not always what you see in the time evolution. So if you're conservative and you put in some, if you're conservative, what matter distributions are around black holes, and they're not a lot compared to the mass of the black hole, then these are small corrections on the level of the potential. And if they're not directly around 3M, you can't really constrain much, I think, if you put in realistic numbers for what this is.
Okay.
I have a question.
Yes.
Thank you for a nice talk. The first a question, then a comment. What can we learn about the nature of the black hole event horizon from LIGO data, the supermassive black holes, etc.? In fact, whether there is a general relativity horizon, because we have two ultra-compact dark objects colliding, producing gravitational waves. What data is there to prove that there is a GR horizon?
Yeah. So if there is no horizon and you would have these reflections, they would show up probably at late times. But the current data, they look for echoes, they look for simple waveforms to take into account the possibility that there is a reflection of this. You can see here from this plot, I mean, this is just like one realization, but the amplitude of these echoes is much smaller than for the rest. So what LIGO can do is for some specific models put bounds on how the reflectivity could look like and where it is located. If you, in a simple analytic model, you could think that if you put your reflection surface, whatever it is, arbitrarily close to the event horizon, that you can delay the signal, this echo time forever in principle. So if you put it epsilon away from the horizon, this gets basically as large as you wanted. But at the same time, this is there's a limit to that, because whatever the shell is, whatever the radiation is, there's at some point there's also back reaction. You can think that if there's a little amount of energy in the gravitational waves that adds the mass of the black hole, at some point, if you're too close, it will form a horizon from this point of view. If you say you don't want to assume any GR physics around the black hole, I would say if there's some sort of reflection, LIGO can put bounds. But an absolute proof that there is an event horizon is probably impossible. You would have to jump in to find out.
That's correct. The comment is that regarding the size of the shadow, as you pointed out, you have to put in the mass of M87 star. And attempts to measure the mass of was over 20 years or more. And the measurement of the mass for M87 star depends on lots of assumptions about the stellar dynamics. It's quite complicated. And some publications show that the mass is around 4 times 10^9 solar mass. And the one that's typically accepted is 6 times 10^9 solar masses, because that's the one that gives the curved black hole. But strictly speaking, there's a problem with knowing the mass at present. It's still controversial.
Yeah, I know. There are different measurements for the mass. I mean, this is another layer of complexity. If you don't know the central mass, you will have another unknown, let's say, in your problem. The motion of S stars, as far as I know, is the precise one that they take to estimate the mass, and the gas dynamics are the one which is not so precise. I mean, they should be the same in the end if you understand both models correctly. That's true. But if you vary the mass by a lot, the size of the black hole would be very different. So in that case, it would definitely not be if the mass would be a few times different, let's say, and you would produce an image size here, the ring size, it would be quite different. That's true. Yeah. So there's a lot of uncertain astrophysics in this image as well. That's true. Yeah. But the point with using this ring size, I mean, is even more, let's say more drastic. Even if all these things would hold, you would know the mass, and if you would know that this ring really comes from it, even then, at least this PM expansion itself is not converging there. So,
yeah, we have to be careful about how we perform tests of GR, because if you if you insert GR, it's a null hypothesis.
Yeah.
Just get out what you put in.
Yeah, so you exactly.
You have to put in a theory, another alternative theory, and to get a test that's not a null hypothesis. And this is not easy. Well, more work has to be done on this.
Certainly, yeah.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for the questions and comments.